magical idealism and the theory of the absolute individual. Following the artistic period came the philosophical one, roughly from 1921 to 1927, though some books written during this time were only published later, up until 1930. To me, just as art was not just about artwork itself, philosophy was not just about abstract ideas or logical arguments. I mentioned that my interest in philosophy dated back to my early adolescence. However, this interest increasingly intertwined with my fascination for doctrines concerning what is superational and transcendent. Even as a young boy, I was profoundly struck by several novels of Merezkowski. Wisdom, presenting it as an antidote to modern materialism, but also to mere dogmatic or devotional religion. Nevertheless, their concepts were confused amalgamations, heavily influenced by biases, incoherent thoughts, and substandard content derived from purported revelations and claimed clairvoyance. However, in such circles, I also had the opportunity to meet individuals of real worth, whose value was separate from the theories they supported. I recall Decio Calvary, president of the Independent Theosophical League of Rome, Giovanni Calazza, who likewise led an anthroposophical, Steinian, center in Rome, the poet Arturo Onofri, who, after belonging to the avant-garde art movement, underwent a spiritual crisis and embraced the same orientation, the Dutch orientalist Bernard Jassink, and the painter and occultist Roel Dahl Molin Ferenczona. Due to my insufficient preparation, my early philosophical works, especially the essays on magical idealism, contain references influenced by the aforementioned questionable sources, which therefore should be treated with caution and distinguished from what is essential. However, on the whole, I remained independent, and in fact, my attitude toward these trends of modern occultism was often markedly critical and negative. In my case, during that period, they served the only useful, though incidental, function they typically hold in the modern world, that of being mere starting points. The individual's internal disposition determines whether he gets stuck on the often confused and rambling teachings of these movements or whether he finds his way back, in one form or another, to the authentic sources of traditional wisdom, recognizing the many cases where occultist, anthroposophical, and theosophical speculations have done more to discredit than to uplift that wisdom. For me, it was clearly the second alternative. For example, I credit Decio Calvary with my initial insights into Tantrism. However, I soon established direct contact with Sir John Woodrowe, Arthur Avalon, a leading and respected scholar of this tradition. From his works and the original Hindu texts he published, I obtained the material that would serve as the foundation for my book El Humo Competenza. From an objective standpoint, my early writings during the philosophical period, including essays and lectures, were influenced by a blending of philosophy and the aforementioned doctrines. This blending sometimes appeared as a contamination, not of philosophy itself, but rather of the doctrines, which, as I would later recognize, underwent a forced and external rationalization. On the other hand, it became evident that such a transposition provided valuable contributions toward addressing certain speculative problems inherent in contemporary thought, as well as an essential broadening of horizons. It was along these lines that I developed the system I referred to as magical idealism and the theory of the absolute individual. As is well known, the term a magical had already been used by Novalis. However, despite Novalis being one of my favorite authors and some of his insights holding essential value for me, the orientation of my system was quite different. The precedence, indeed the priority, of the non-philosophical background over the speculative elaborations is evident from the fact that my first book, published immediately after the artistic period, was a presentation of the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu. Through a reference, sometimes quite debatable, to this ancient master of Far Eastern Taoism, I anticipated several essential ideas of my system. At the same time, the book served as a sort of link between the two phases, as certain anti-rationalistic and paradoxical aspects of Lao Tzu share a certain affinity with the positions of Dadaism, despite a completely different background. The booklet was published in 1923 by Kaaba under the title Il Noi Libro della Via e della Virtù. The version was primarily based on A. Euler's translation and left much to be desired. However, it is important to highlight that the meanings I attributed to the text, While my then claim to evaluate it critically in terms of a modern thought, using some clichés from Western idealistic philosophy, should be dismissed as frivolous. In the Chinese master, I admired the calm and clarity of thought that remains untainted by emotion, a figure who successfully outlined a metaphysics of the divine, exemplifying a model for a superior being, the completed one, free from any mysticism or faith, and existing in a magical and radiant state of detachment. I identified the essence of this metaphysics in the concept of the Wei, or Tao, understood as the process by which a being is fulfilled through the realization of non-being. The world and creation represent an eternal flow and continuous production, generated by the atemporal act through which the principle distances itself from itself, empties itself, thereby realizing itself in a supersubstantiality, the symbol of emptiness, the substrate, foundation, and meaning of all existence, much like the empty central space of a wheel represents its essence and center of gravity. Naturally, there was a strong temptation to relate these concepts from a wisdom framework to modern absolute idealism. However, even though I had not yet distinctly articulated it at the time, a fundamental orientation emerged, mediated by Lao Tzu, which differentiated the system I later constructed from idealistic philosophy. In fact, Lao Tzu's concept of a non-action stood in stark contrast to the imminent identification of the subject with the act, and the act with the fact, Ian. Identification that I would vehemently oppose in both its essence and historical applications. The principle, fundamentally aristocratic, of detachment and impassibility was thus brought to the forefront. By emulating the divine model, the perfect one, the real man, or transcendent man of Taoism does not identify with the external, does not intervene directly, and does not externalize his self through self-assertion. Instead, he practices an active renunciation of beings and acting in a direct and conditioned sense. In doing so, he realizes the essential element, enters the way, and becomes elusive, inexhaustible, invulnerable, and incapable of being bent or reduced to impotence. He is also capable of exercising a subtle, invisible, and magical action, the Wei Wu Wei, or acting without acting, the sovereign and irresistible spontaneity, that is the action or virtue, Ti, of the Wei, the Tao. I needed to present all these arguments in their proper form, ensuring greater accuracy, purity, and fidelity to the sources in a second version of the same text, compiled approximately 36 years later at the request of a friend. This version was published by Seskina in 1959 under a different title, The Book of the Principle and Its Action. This version is preceded by a comprehensive essay on Taoism in general. The text itself has been significantly revised and aligned better with scientific standards. Most importantly, the interpretation has completely eliminated idealistic philosophical insights and any other references to modern Western thought. Instead, the text is integrated into the context of Eastern spirituality to which it belongs and is clarified and interpreted in traditional terms, consistent with the orientation of my third period, the post-philosophical phase. As for the presentation in 1923, at that time I had not yet experienced a direct and authentic sensation of the spiritual climate of that wisdom. While it is true that I avoided the blatant clichés of those who spoke of the passivity and quietism of Taoism, and that I fundamentally grasped its higher, metaphysical dimension, there were still distortions in my understanding. More than once, I spoke almost as if there were an exclusion of transcendence, evidently in reference to the hypostatic transcendence found in certain incidental philosophies or theologies. Only in the second presentation is it made clear that, in Taoism, what is actually at stake is rather an immanent transcendence, the direct presence of non-being, in its positive sense, a superontological essence, within being, the infinitely distant, the heaven, in the near, the beyond of nature within nature, maintaining equal distance from both pantheistic immanence and transcendence as merely speculative concepts corresponding to a direct experience stemming from the specific existential structure of the primordial human being. In that youthful work, the opposition between the common self and the absolute individual was already established. However, despite some references and an appendix related to Matt Joy, who interprets Eastern doctrines in esoteric terms, I did not adequately emphasize the essentially initiatory dimension of Taoism and its ideal of the real man and the transcendent man. At that time, I wrote, having torn through the dense, opaque clouds of anguish, doubt, and passion that cloud our external humanity, he, Lao Tzu, depicts the anatomy and internal logic of the divine in a cool, calm atmosphere, revealing it as the very rationality of reality. He thereby makes it true in the spirit by identifying it with the very nature of man as the absolute individual, as the perfect being. Every subsequent religion or philosophy, far from surpassing his positions, has rarely been able to grasp them in the clear and pure nakedness in which they existed in the mind of the great Chinese. Beyond these, history retains only the scattered and uncertain sparks of various mysticisms. The one-sidedness of the last sentence is evident. Aside from that various mysticisms, a rather ambiguous reference, it did not take into account other equally metaphysical traditions that I would later address in detail. Furthermore, the idea of proposing this transcendent wisdom almost as a remedy for the modern consciousness in crisis was naive. I wrote, most religions and moralities have only succeeded in insulting man, as they have considered him to be what he is not, as a creature. However, all of this is now inadequate for modern consciousness, which has begun to realize the sense of absolute reality and the solitude of the person. However, the price of this conquest has been everything that once constituted his life and faith, his illusion. Thus, man today appears as a castaway clinging to a self that he does not yet understand without tainting it, yet intuitively recognizes as his only certainty. He finds himself without religion, faith, or enthusiasm, caught between a science that is fracturing within itself and a philosophy that has become an exaggerated formalism, empty in its self-sufficiency. Thirsting for freedom, he is nonetheless rigid in his opposition to a nature, society, and culture in which he can no longer find his identity. It is in this context that I sought to highlight the relevance of Lao Tzu's teachings. A similar theme was also explored in my lectures and at the beginning of essays on magical idealism. The modern man must learn about the self that he still struggles to articulate, which manifests in the distorted images represented by Stirner's Unique One or the Social Man of Marx and Lenin, the absolute self of idealism, or the lyrical subject of avant-garde aesthetics. Notably, the Superman of Nietzsche was omitted from this list. As a positive point of reference, I indicated the path outlined by Lao Tzu, interpreted as that of the absolute individual. While the theme of the crisis of modern humanity was accurate, and I was to develop it extensively in other works, there was a clear misunderstanding in attempting to place an initiatory ideal within a historical situationality and reducing it to a nearly general formula. This ideal, in fact, is essentially atemporal and has no connection to any specific society or culture. In terms of realizability, it is further removed from the modern man than from individuals of any other era. At that time, I could not see these things with sufficient clarity. I had not yet freed myself from the influences of modern culture and mentality. However, this encounter with Lao Tzu already awakened certain elective affinities. The ideal of Olympic superiority, opposed to any Western activism and vitalism, was beginning to take shape. Now, it is necessary to discuss the systematic philosophical works I wrote after those initial anticipations. The impetus to express my worldview and values systematically, with the requisite scholarly apparatus and the conventional academic jargon, was partly due to a polemical situation. In my philosophical studies, my interest had shifted to the current of post-Kantian transcendental idealism. Unlike most followers of this school, I clearly perceived the non-philosophical, pre-rational foundation of this preference. For me, this foundation was the will to dominate. An author from that period, Grunbaum, had already recognized this distinctly in his essay Love and Domination as fundamental themes of philosophical worldviews, later, existentialist analysis, anticipated by Nietzsche, or even psychoanalytic interpretations of philosophical systems would become popular, while the professional idealist philosophers remained unaware of it, believing they were following a purely objective line of speculation by adopting that philosophy. Thus, my preference manifested the influence of one of those two components of my personal equation, as I mentioned earlier. At the same time, I was convinced that the current of transcendental idealism represented the liminal stage reached by critical reflection applied to the problems of certainty and knowledge, the epistemological issue. I felt it was almost a mission to revisit the positions reached along this line and to go further, adhering rigorously to the original impetus that had given life to that philosophy. Ultimately, it would emerge that this was also the path toward an imminent self-transcendence of philosophy in general and that my philosophical works presented themselves as a sort of preparatory stage for eventual access to a domain that was no longer that of discursive thought and speculation, but rather that of inner, realizational action aimed at surpassing human limits and action informed by the teachings I had simultaneously come to know. It was not by chance that I chose the following words from Jaya Lagno as the motto for the opening of my essays: philosophy is the reflection that ultimately recognizes its own insufficiency and the necessity of an absolute action arising from within. The conviction that this further step needed to be taken was so deeply rooted in me that, despite the considerable effort involved and the extensive specialized preparation required, I proposed to a wealthy friend that he publish my main work, Teoria e Phenomenologia dell'Individuo Assoluto, under his name. My primary concern was to establish the boundaries of modern thought, rather than to assert my identity as the author. However, the proposal did not materialize, as this individual insisted on making additions and modifications, which I could not accept. The earlier mentioned polemical incentive stemmed from the dominance of neo-Hegelianism in Italy, particularly in the forms articulated by Croce and, above all, Gentile. Having interacted with some representatives of this movement, I was irritated by their outrageous presumption. As mere intellectuals, they presented themselves as the pontiffs of critical thought and proclaimers of the absolute spirit's message, looking down upon and dismissing beloved thinkers of mine as dilettantes for their refusal to systematize deeply lived intuitions and visions of much greater dignity according to the rules, using Schopenhauer's phrase of philosophy for professors of philosophy. It was, in fact, a world of pompous rhetoric. What repelled me even more was the coexistence of the petty bourgeois type, salary-earning, married, and conformist, with the theory he embraced of the absolute, free self as the creator of the world and history. Needless to say, for these individuals, the wisdom doctrines I had begun to explore were merely superstitions, relics long surpassed by the unfolding of critical awareness. This perspective, however, was to be expected, as secular enlightenment was, after all, their true intellectual foundation. I had to set things right. To this end, I began systematically studying the original texts of the classic idealistic thinkers, from Kant to Hegel and the later Schelling. This necessitated learning German, as most of their works had not yet been translated at the time. After these studies, it became evident to me how utterly impoverished and vacuous the Italian epigones of this philosophy were, who had absurdly reduced its original demands to a contrived game of dialectics consisting of merely a few scant categories. In Gentile's case, this was compounded by a vague grandiosity and an unbearable paternalistic pedagogism. Regardless of any intrinsic solidity, there was no comparison to the classic works of idealism, such as Schelling's Philosophy of Nature and Mythology, Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit and Encyclopedia, and the various doctrines of science by Fichte, in terms of genius, inventiveness, creative impulse, and the powerful effort to encompass the diverse reality and material of experience. Croce, in a letter, honored me by describing one of my subsequent books as well-framed and reasoned with precision. While I recognized that he, whom I also met personally, demonstrated greater ethical qualities and intellectual acuity than Gentile, I could not overlook the low level of purely discursive thought that ultimately abandoned the realm of significant speculative problems to scatter into essays, literary criticism, and a secular liberal historiography. Nonetheless, my studies had equipped me to challenge them on their own turf. I had mastered their jargon, which they regarded as a mark of seriousness and modern, scientific thought. However, my intellectual horizons extended beyond the confines of strictly idealistic themes. In addition to the non-discursive knowledge I previously mentioned, the foundational orientation of my speculative constructions was significantly shaped by Nietzsche and Michael Stadter. Furthermore, my engagement with French personalism, including thinkers like Lachelier, Secretan, Bouteroux, Lagno, Renouvier, Hamelin, and Blondel, was important, particularly concerning the concept of true freedom. These thinkers were largely overlooked or only superficially acknowledged by Italian idealists, whose cultural focus was often narrowly provincial, primarily confined to the Hegelian tradition, and frequently unfamiliar even with the original texts. Essays on Magical Idealism, published in 1925 by the Latinor Editions, served as a precursor to the content of Teoria e Phenomenologia dell'Individuo Assoluto. It was a preview for the public, as the latter work was nearly completed, I just could not determine when I would be able to publish it. Thus, there is little need to discuss that book separately here. Aside from its critical and constructive core, two aspects warrant attention. The first pertains to the extensive references to wisdom and initiatory doctrines, which could strike a common reader, especially one familiar with mainstream philosophy, as strange and unusual. This was, in part, a foreshadowing of what I would later present explicitly, stripping away any extraneous elements and dubious sources in subsequent post-philosophical works, in a form appropriate to the content. The aim was an exhaustive effort to systematize and logically present the experiences, disciplines, and achievements of high asceticism, yoga, magic, and initiation. This was especially evident in the lengthy chapter titled The Essence of Magical Development, which would be revisited and expanded in the final part of Phenomenologia dell'Individuo Assoluto. Other essays published separately, such as La Purita cum Valor Metaphysico, ed. Bilicnus, also belong to this rationalizing and systematizing approach. Collectively, they represent an almost unprecedented attempt. Few had previously engaged in systematically and dialectically exploring such unconventional and, for many, discredited subjects, aside from figures like Marcus, von Baader, Heymann, and Schopenhauer in some of his essays. Secondly, in the final chapter of the book, titled Contemporary Demands for Magical Idealism, I considered a group of significant modern thinkers to identify the deep motive that informs their conceptions and to demonstrate how, when this motive is allowed to operate freely within their systems, it inevitably leads to the positions of magical idealism outlined in the other essays of the book. This group included C. Michael Starter, O. Braun, in his case, the scant traces of a lived experience captured in the diary of this adolescent who perished in World War I, G. Gentile, H. Heinlein, and H. Kieseling. This represented a kind of immanent critique that would necessitate the transition to the conceptions I defended, aside from the separation and collection of valid elements from my perspective. Naturally, these authors, the list could have been considerably extended, did not exemplify mere critical idealism. H. Kieseling did not deserve the attention he received. Knowing him personally made it clear to me that I was in the presence of a mere salon philosopher, vain, narcissistic, and incredibly pretentious. In his writings, I was struck by his concept of creative knowledge, which involves changing one state of awareness to activate the function of meaning. This meaning, which encompasses things and facts, animates them and uses them as material for free expression within a framework that is not merely subjective, as seen in lyricism and art, since the very substrate of reality could and should be invested to remove its necessity and opacity. Not without reference to certain Eastern doctrines, Kieseling established a school of wisdom in Darmstadt that, after a brief and ephemeral existence, vanished without a trace. In reality, the creator of this school was, as a person, the last one who could embody the dignity of a master. Everything in him reduced to sporadic intuitions, reminiscent of those common among Slavs. Kieseling was of Baltic descent, devoid of any solid foundation. Regarding my system, it was therefore based on an immanent critique of transcendental idealism, particularly in its claim, or presumption, to represent the ultimate limit of modern, critical thought. Later, I should more accurately say, to represent the thought of the modern crisis. I accepted Hegel's assertion that every philosophy is idealism and that when it appears as non-idealism, it is merely an idealism not fully aware of itself. At the same time, I highlighted the hidden meaning and the irrational root of idealism, which consists, as I mentioned, in a will to be and to dominate. Therefore, according to the specific meaning I attribute to this term, which I will return to later, it embodies an essentially a magical impulse. I indicated as a manifestation of this tendency the fact that the demand for absolute certainty as imminent had been the center and driving force of all developments in transcendental critical philosophy. in the negation of any other as a result of the logical investigation into the possibility of knowledge and, at the same time, as a necessary condition for a system of absolute certainty, there appears, reflected in the world of ideas, a profound drive for self-affirmation and domination. Thus, it was a kind of existential analysis of idealism, indeed of the very root of the epistemological problem. I concluded by stating that it is a Nietzsche, a Weininger, a Michelstaedter who give meaning to a Descartes, a Berkeley, a Kant, and a Fichte. But the impulse in question within idealism had undergone a syncopation, indeed a reversal. Here, I could have spoken of a process of dissociation and self-alienation. The ideal cherished by such philosophers had been projected and realized, in the sense that psychiatrists use the term realized in relation to hallucinatory processes, on an abstract, speculative level, becoming detached from the real individual, from the living totality of the person, who was increasingly excluded and degraded. I demonstrated that idealism could only progress from phase to phase in solving its speculative problem, in the sense of immanence and the elimination of any transcendence, to the extent that this alienation continued to deepen. Here, it is not necessary to reproduce my arguments. I will limit myself to a brief overview. In a certain way, the juxtaposition of idealism is summarized in Berkeley's formula, es ist percipi, meaning that the only being of which I can concretely and sensibly speak is that which corresponds to my perception, my thought, or my representation. Of any other being, I know nothing, and therefore, it is as if it does not exist. This position has been expanded, to which I myself have contributed, to refer not only to perception, but also to that common foundation of every faculty, which is constituted by an elementary act of consciousness. Absolute idealists attribute to this fact the character of unpositing. While Schopenhauer stated, following Kant, the world is my representation, they, following Fichte, asserted, the world is my positing, whereas the epigones even spoke of creation. It took a particular skill to grapple with everything that the self understands only indirectly, through other individuals, social interactions, culture, history, and so on. The underlying, and essentially trivial, reality is this: if one strips away the content of my consciousness, thought, and experience, regardless of how one defines the function of being for itself, they would dissolve into nothingness. The circle is complete. In one crucial aspect, nearly all idealists fail to explore deeply enough, not for theoretical reasons, but rather for moral and human ones, regarding the denial of any self-sufficient reality of other subjects and other selves. Various speculative strategies have been employed to sidestep this thorny issue and to avoid confronting the chilling prospect of the unique's cosmic solitude amidst a world of Maya that obscures not only nature, things, and the heavens, but also other beings. However, I did not shy away from this challenge and demonstrated the inevitability of what is often termed solipsism, a somewhat inadequate label when one adheres to idealistic epistemology. Moreover, aside from speculative arguments, does dreaming not illustrate how other beings can appear real, act unpredictably, and even terrify us, while ultimately being mere projections of our imagination? It becomes even more troubling when we consider the coherence and logic exhibited by the so-called real world, in contrast to the chaotic nature of dreams. All of this presupposes the conditioning use of categories of reason that, as Kant noted, exist only within us, within the transcendental subject. Without these, everything would remain in the incoherent state of madness or dreaming. Thus, on a purely gnoseological level, critical and cognitive, the circle is indeed complete. The world can only be the my world. Even if there were something beyond this, something objective, I could never truly know it. At the moment of knowing, much like how things turn to gold upon contact with Midas, it would transform into my thought, my experience, or my representation. In other words, it would, in one way or another, yield to my conditioning. On this basis, all doubt seemed to be eliminated, closing the door to mystery. The self was provided with a solid and inaccessible bastion where it could feel secure, free, and in control. However, a sufficiently rigorous and honest examination reveals a profound flaw within this entire system. To claim that the world is my representation, my experience, or my e-thought is one thing, to assert instead that the world is my positing toward creation is quite another. Moreover, a distinction exists between the self as posited by idealists and the concrete self to which each individual can refer, not theoretically or philosophically, but practically. Once the world, not merely the realm of true ideas and sentiments, but also that of things and beings in space and time, is deemed real and certain solely as thought and a system of thought, it remains essential to question the ultimate status of the self within such an immanented a world and in relation to the function that posits it. If the self were to possess only the abstract capacity for thought, the difficulty might still be surmountable. One could envision the self as a kind of impersonal transcendental mechanism, emanating and presenting before us everything that can be known and experienced, akin to the dream state, in which one rarely recognizes oneself as both the spectator and the creator of what unfolds through the automatism of imagination. However, reducing the self to such a concept is impossible, even regarding the psyche of the most bewildered and stupefied of human beings. Thus, akin to Atlas shedding its cosmic burden, the idealist dismisses the real self and seeks refuge in the so-called transcendental self, or absolute spirit, also referred to as logos, idea, or pure act. This abstraction is attributed to cosmogonic activity, leading the idealist to declare that, in the presence of such a self, the concrete personality of the individual is nothing but an illusion and a fiction, what Gentile even termed a puppet of the imagination. One would partake in truth, certainty, reality, ethics, spirituality, and historicity only to the extent that one identifies with that entity. This is where my critique directly intervened. I argued that the self is not adequately defined as mere thought, representation, or a gnoseological subject, but rather through the concepts of freedom, action, and will. Simply placing these values at the center is enough to destabilize the entire system of abstract idealism. If the transcendental self proposed by the idealists was not just a rebranded version of the Creator God, dismissed by these philosophers as a superstitious and uncritical hypostasis, essentially a construct of thought, then it must bear some relation to our actual, lived being. The inevitable consequence of this is a paradoxical, regressive collapse. Foremost, much of what I think, not in the strict sense, but in the transcendental sense, that which corresponds to the world of objective appearances, can be attributed to myself, allowing me to consider that world as apposited by me only by referring to an unconscious function. E. von Hartmann had already highlighted this through a serious realist critique, which, of course, the idealists dismissed as irrelevant. In addition to the unconscious nature of that function, we must also consider its non-intentionality, unpredictability, and contingency. No idealist could ever predict, for instance, what their thought will apposit in the form of the person they meet around the corner or the words their interlocutor will speak. Another key feature is passivity. Here, my critique of the famous Hegelian formula of the identity of the real and the rational, everything real is rational, and everything rational is real, comes into play, along with the post-Hegelian idea of the identity of the real and the willed, of fact and act, leading to the so-called concrete will our theory. In light of these formulas, one must ask, do we call something real because it is rational? Similarly, do we call something real because it is willed, and thus real only insofar as it is truly willed, while remaining non-real as a corollary to the absence of will? Or do we call it willed, as a fact of the act, as a posited, etc., merely because it is real, due to the simple and irrational fact of its existence or occurrence? It was evident that for the vast majority of what the transcendental self posits or creates, only the second alternative is valid. In the case of absolute idealists, it is reality that determines what they consider rational and willed. This essentially means acknowledging the fundamental passivity of the true self, allowing things, history, and contingencies to dictate what it would have freely willed. To expose the absurdity of these ideas, I offered a drastic argument: an idealist subjected to torture would have to deem his situation as rational and willed by him, by the true self, simply because it is real. He would have to see his resistance and suffering as irrational whims of the empirical self, a puppet of the imagination. A similar scenario applies to much of our experience, both in theoretical and practical spheres. In a later chapter of Men and the Ruins, I would go on to denounce the immorality of this doctrine, especially in its historicist and political applications. I established a fundamental distinction between a truly free act and a passive act, which I also termed spontaneity. In a free act, there exists a gap between the possible and the actual, where the possible exceeds the actual. A power precedes and governs the act, serving as the ultimate reason for whether the act occurs or not, and for determining why it is this particular act rather than another. In a passive or spontaneous act, this gap is absent, and there is a direct, automatic transition to action, or perception, representation, etc., as if driven by automatism. In such cases, the possible is entirely consumed by the actual, by what happens, is felt, or is seen. Thus, when referring to a spontaneity, I am addressing something that is indeed a mine, but not truly is me, because, as with emotions and passions, I cannot claim that I directly initiate it, I am neither the unconditional cause of its determinations, nor in control of them. I therefore clarified a crucial point: not being determined by external forces is one thing, being truly and positively free is another. In Teoria dell'Individuo Assoluto, I devoted an entire chapter to critiquing all false concepts of freedom, a critique which, I believe, has never been pursued with such radical rigor elsewhere. The conclusion of my entire argument was as follows: the idealistic reduction of nature and much of the world of real experience to a position of the self is only successful to the extent that the self itself is reduced to nature, that is, only to the extent that the self itself is reduced to nature, meaning, when nothing is known, or rather, when it is as though nothing is known of that self, which is freedom. In doing so, an evident paralogism is committed: the concept of the self is conflated with that of the principle of spontaneity, which is, in fact, the concept of nature. It turned out that, in relation to the true self, transcendental cosmogonic activity either had to be considered as entirely unconscious, or it would take on the characteristics of a passive, unintentional, unpredictable, and purposeless activity, merely spontaneous. It thus became clear that if the idealists had genuinely followed, not just in philosophical abstractions, but in practice, the principle of aligning the real person with the transcendental self, with pure act, or whatever else they called their new God, they would have embarked on a path of absolute regression into the subpersonal. Even more so than the various philosophers of life and irrationalism, whom the idealists regarded with haughty disdain. I highlighted the various stages of transcendental philosophy, from Kant to Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, Weber, and Gentile, as a progressive retreat from the real self. The self does not create the form that gnosiologically dominates the contingency of phenomena, the Schlegelian chaos outside the system, except as the actual consciousness of Gentile, that is, in absolute adherence to the spontaneous, representative act through which things emerge and assert themselves in the consciousness of the self. This leads, in effect, to a kind of passive mysticism that would concretely identify with an absolute, stupefied phenomenalism. The individual does not truly exist, but yields; it does not dominate reality, but dissolves within it. This is the path of decline. This marked the conclusion of the critical phase of my system and the commencement of the constructive aspect. Once such a state of affairs was acknowledged with honesty and courage, what remained to be done? For those who had genuinely engaged with the idealistic experience, not merely indulging in philosophy for academic purposes, the only recourse was to dismiss it as a form of delusion or to seek a loophole to introduce some semblance of religious transcendence. However, for those who remained steadfast, the only option was to thread the perilous path I sought to delineate. I must primarily limit myself to brief references here. The positive aspect of my system begins with the postulation of the experience of the pure self, a detached self, a center unto itself, pure being, an absolute self-evidence, antecedent to any determined content of consciousness and even to the very faculty of thought. Thus, in opposition to Descartes, I assert not I think, therefore I am, but rather I am, therefore I think, viewing thought merely as a faculty or possibility of the self. This experience is posited as contingent; it may occur or not, is indeducible, and serves as an absolute principle unto itself. Similarly, Weininger referred to that event of the self, while Rimbaud spoke of that self, which is another. Hindu metaphysics presents the self, or Atman, as pure light, paralleling the classical concept of. Later, Husserl's phenomenology, of which I was entirely unaware at the time, would attempt a similar approach, though it quickly halted, by discussing the phenomenological reduction aimed at revealing this self as a pure, immobile center of light. It is essential to emphasize that this is not a conceptual or theoretical matter, but rather a pure fact of experience, albeit one not derived from ordinary experience. Subsequently, I moved on to define the concept of value, assigning a specific meaning to the term. This value represented the only relationship in accordance with justice that the self could establish. With its determinations, a term that in my terminology referred to every content of lived experience. This relationship was to include three elements: the transparency of a meaning, a lived meaning, not abstract or intellectual, within the determinations, a direct relationship of unity with oneself within the determination, in terms of possession or dominion, and finally, the character of what pertains to a bare and free will. However, to maintain a firm grasp on that self and, consequently, on the principle or imperative of a value as a condition for the rationality of existence in a higher sense involves facing difficulties similar to those found in abstract idealism. Just as the reality of that self is evident, once one has experienced the phenomenon I posited, so is, within what I referred to as the empirical state of existence, the presence of material reality and experience, though the relationship of these to me is certainly not characterized by value. At that time, I was unaware of existentialism. Many years would pass before this philosophy, along with Husserl's phenomenology, gained prominence due to the changing climate of contemporary civilization. Nonetheless, I was essentially echoing its core themes here: the paradoxical and irrational coexistence and mutual implication of the finite and the infinite, the conditioned and the unconditioned, in real existence. I have already mentioned the personal crisis I experienced years earlier concerning this very situation. While existentialism merely acknowledged this paradox and irrationality, indulging in the resulting state of crisis or seeking evasions that led to an internal compromise, a topic I explored in Riding the Tiger, which includes a critical analysis of existentialism, I took that structure of existence as the foundation for my theory of the absolute individual. At this point, the concept of absolute freedom re-emerged. In my critique of idealism, I observed that a dogmatic initial formula was always introduced surreptitiously. For instance, the notion of the dialectic of concrete logo suggested that the spirit must disrupt its pure identity by distinguishing itself through self-positing, equated with positing a determined object or the non-self, to later recognize itself within it, implying a process of becoming. But why must the spirit undertake this? If the answer is that otherwise the spirit would not be spirit, but nature, one could counter, why should it not simply remain as it is? Freedom must exist. Furthermore, as noted by others, such as Hamelin, the entire development of categories they used to idealistically explain and justify the given world, at least its fundamental aspects, was traced back to the spirit constructing its own freedom. Again, we must ask, is this construction achieved freely or out of necessity? In the latter case, it becomes absurd to speak of freedom. One would merely be subject to a given law, just like any other. Thus, I defended the idea of absolute freedom that is, in a sense, prior to itself, as realized freedom, freedom understood as pure arbitrariness that could unconditionally choose both itself and its negation, the negation of itself. This implies that the self should have access to both the path of the value, as previously defined, and that of non-value, presenting two compossible options. Thus, the paradoxical and irrational situation of that empirical state of existence seemed to be resolved in a higher meaning. The actual coexistence of the finite and the infinite, the conditioned and the unconditioned, dramatizes, in a sense, the dual possibility and demands a fundamental decision. Just as fire can reclaim the existence of fuel through its deep will to manifest and blaze. Fourth, the self, which desires itself as autarch, can reclaim its non-being and, indeed, serve as the very matter from which it can unleash the brilliance of absolute life and activity. Doctrinally, this led to the definition of two paths, the path of the other on one side and the path of the absolute individual on the other. In this regard, I drew from Michael Starter and subsequently developed several key points. Michael Starter referred to the path of persuasion, understood as the existence that is self-sufficient, possessing within itself its own principle and value. This path does not reject or escape its existential deficiency, but rather accepts and resolves it. Opposed to this path is the path of rhetoric, that of the one who flees from the current possession of self, relying on external sources, seeking the other, and submitting to another to persuade of himself in a temporal escape driven by obscure necessity and an incessant yearning, indefinitely. Deferring the initial surrender and excluding any cessation of the process in a genuine possession. Michael Starter likely overlooked that such a conception essentially aligns with Buddhism and ancient mysticism. The path of the other, which I also termed the path of the object, corresponds in Buddhism to samsara, the lower world of becoming driven by thirst and desire, and in ancient mysticism to the circle of generation, also known as the circle of necessity. Conversely, the other path represents that of the awakened and liberated in Buddhism, as well as that of the consecrated figures of the ancient mysteries. The innovative and daring aspect of my conception was to view both paths as equally valid, each must be as possible and legitimate as the other, grounded in the principle of supreme freedom. The true absolute must encompass the potential for both the absolute and the non-absolute. Due to its intrinsic nature, the path of the other can only be subject to a schematic structural determination, in which a fundamental situation is uniformly reiterated. In contrast, the path of the absolute individual allows for partial determination, articulating it became my objective in the second part of Theoria and throughout the entirety of Phenomenologia. I will refrain from discussing the new theory of certainty that could be formulated here, as it has already been the subject of an essay titled The Three Epochs of the Problem of Certainty, which was published in German in the journal Logos and later reproduced as the first part of my El Individuo e Illinois Divinia del Mondo, Libreria di Scienze Letter, 1926. Instead, I will briefly outline the overall framework. I began by addressing the idealistic positions that my previous critique had clarified. The world is imposited by the self. However, it becomes evident, in many instances, that I am powerless, lacking the value necessary for this positing. To pave the way, I turn to a critique of philosophical realism. To explain the impotence of the self, the realist introduces a real being that reveals itself through representation, imagery, and perception, thus determining them. However, this inference is not only gnoseologically illicit, as Kant noted, it is a transcendent use of the principle of causality, but is also not compelling. It suffices to refer to an activity that, while belonging to the self, has a character of necessity, specifically, a spontaneity, which corresponds to the privation of will and the inherent relationship to value. This observation could and should have sufficed. In the path of the absolute individual, the imperative is to not flee from this deficiency and to not concede it a separate reality by corresponding it to a distinct reality, a nature, thing in itself, or God. Instead, after recognizing this deficiency, one must become sufficient unto it, taking it entirely upon oneself and holding firm, to be the privation, to understand everything that cannot be considered reality or value, as is often the case with the tendency to equate the rational with the real and the willed with the real, as negativity. Beyond this, one must affirm the act that consumes this deficiency so that what was previously non-existent in the deficiency of central activity becomes absolute being. In short, non-being, the privation, should not be conflated with being. In this sense, the postulated process was analogous, on a cosmic epistemological or ontological epistemological scale, to the way one reacts against a passion or instinct, freeing oneself from necessity and transfiguring it into a genuine act. Thus, ethics and ontology converged. There was also an eschatological backdrop, nature, as a privation, non-being, the realization of the absolute individual occurs at the point where non-being is redeemed and transitions into a state of absolute being, encompassing both its principle and end, the final consummation, or epirosis. This entailed a transcendence of Stoicism in an amplified sense, along with a critique of Michael Starter's position. The idealistic premise, if maintained, inescapably binds the self to the world. I cannot escape the world, because it is my representation. the path of the other, characterized by a yearning identification that places reality and the meaning of being in what lies beyond oneself, remains open. However, in the path of the absolute individual, I cannot isolate myself in an abstract sufficiency, opposing the self as value to the non-value of the world, to which I deny reality, even though it exists. As it is posited by me, even if not through free will, but rather as spontaneity, I am responsible for the world. If I am not to be torn apart at the core of my being, it must be resolved into value. The Gnostic Manichaean conception of the cosmic one crucified within the world as the meaning of being in the world reappeared, though without dualism or pessimism, the closed circle that allows for neither excuses nor escape. The Stoic self and Stirner's unique one had to manifest as the pure Aristotelian act, which transcends the world of necessity and the interplay between life and non-life. As a synthesis of this entire conception, it is fitting to reproduce a passage from Essays on Magical Idealism: the mere representative activity is a necessary condition, but not a sufficient one, for the reality of things, as these things are related to a self. I can claim to have posited these things, but only in terms of spontaneity, not as a self, that is, not as freedom. To say that I, as the self or sufficient principle, autarx, cannot recognize myself as the unconditional cause of representations, for instance, of nature, does not imply that these representations are caused by an other, by real or inherently existing things. Rather, it simply means that I am inadequate to a part of my activity, which remains spontaneity, that this part is not yet moralized, and that the self, as freedom, experiences a privation within it. Therefore, as previously stated, a fin de non recevoir must be invoked against realism. When, then, can the idealistic principle, that the self posits things, truly be affirmed? When the individual has transformed the dark passion of the world into a body of freedom, that is, when he has shifted the form in which he experiences representative activity from spontaneity, an overlap of reality and possibility, to unconditional, arbitrary causality, into potency. In confronting this task, the idealist instead flees to the real act that possesses and nullifies things. He substitutes the discursive act, which merely recognizes and relies on them. He calls non-being his being, labeling as real what, being a deprivation of his potency, ought to be considered unreal in accordance with justice. In doing so, he confirms this deprivation, flatters it, and obsessively feeds on it. Inadequate to the essence of the self, he abdicates and dissolves into things. Terms like rationality, ideality, historicity, concrete freedom, and transcendental self are merely different names for this flight. These are merely symbols of its impotence, the value forcefully attributed to what, in relation to the essence of the self or morality, in the Weiningerian and Michelstaedterian sense, is non-value, death and darkness, nature. However, a flaw appeared in the system of this new absolute immanentism. Even if one accepted the transformative progression inherent in the path of the absolute individual, the state of privation was acknowledged at the outset as an unexplained mystery. I rejected the problem itself, first by highlighting the conditionality of this darkness, which arises only in relation to the positing of the absolute self. Without this positing, that characteristic is non-existent, as seen in those who simply let life unfold or who merge dionysiacally with life, etc. Secondly, I questioned why what comes first should be considered complete and perfect. The concept of privation, the key idea for explaining the supposed non-self, could be understood as something inherently tied to everything that exists in potency but can evolve into the completeness of a perfect act. Furthermore, this perspective allowed me to indulge in an idiosyncratic focus from which I had not yet fully liberated myself, namely, the concept of a value, now understood not in the previously mentioned specific sense but in a moral idealistic context. If perfection were at the beginning, what significance could activity, effort, and struggle hold for the self? Being, truth, and certainty do not lie behind, but rather ahead, they represent tasks, I asserted. There is no otherness between the person and the universal subject. Instead, there is a sense of progressiveness. The person is the universal subject in potency, while the universal subject is the person in act. I came to assert, if God is, the self is not, regarding the creation of God as a pure possibility of the self. I then refrained from emphasizing this pathos and attributed the fixations on a value and creation to the plebeian ideology of the self-made man, placing these perspectives in their proper context, thus relativizing them. Nonetheless, the notion of an autonomous and free development, progressing from lesser to greater with an ontological foundation, almost in an Aristotelian sense, remained valid, culminating in a pure act, a monad of monads, or a god posited at the end of this process. Therefore, the dialectic I employed in delineating the phenomenologia was not of the Hegelian type, characterized by transitions between opposites and the negation of the finite. Instead, it represented a dialectic of the distinct, signifying a movement from the formless to the formed and individuated, achieved through increasingly higher levels of integration, completeness, and freedom. From this perspective, it must be stated that the absolute self does not exist, rather, there is the contingent possibility for the self to make itself absolute. I also addressed other speculative technical issues, such as the relationship between essence and existence, which presents an additional challenge for abstract idealism. This philosophical framework has consistently struggled to adequately account for the distinction between a represented entity, or its concept, the essence, and a real entity, a distinction that invariably arises within the confines of immanentism. In seeking a solution, I once again turn to the concepts of power and intensive degrees. The idea is a weak reality, whereas reality constitutes a powerful idea, or a more powerful one. There is no fundamental divide, rather, there is only a difference in intensity. Taine characterized perception as a true hallucination, while Berkeley differentiated between a real representation and merely mental representation by relating the former to a more powerful spirit, effectively establishing an intensive difference. Another formulation I proposed is that the idea represents a reality in potency, while reality embodies an idea in act. It was an audacious and perilous theory, one that also led to action. Paradoxically, one could refer to the gradual process undergone by a self whose power extends from simply thinking to magically imagining, then to self-suggestion, to the suggestion of others, and ultimately, at the extreme, to suggesting reality itself and transforming it. Given such concepts, one might easily dismiss them as delirious. However, a suitably adjusted framework could yield greater plausibility. In this context, the traditional doctrine concerning the relationships between macrocosm and microcosm became pertinent. In particular, one should refer, though I did not at the time, to the concept of the so-called intellectual intuition, which is also inherent in scholastic thought and was invoked by Kant too. Contrast this form of knowledge with the sensitive and passive perceptions of the ordinary person. Importantly, I did not oppose these two modes of perception. Here again, a relationship of potency to act was indicated, suggesting a development beyond human limitations. Intellectual intuition, in scholastic thought, was ascribed not to humans but to angelic entities. Documented evidence shows that in certain traditions, particularly within yoga, the phases of the active process of creation or the actualization of intellectual intuition are specifically delineated, leading to a point of active and metaphysical union with the object, this union encompassing both magical and nuptic possibilities. This topic is addressed in a chapter of essays and in El Humo Como Potenza. I will highlight two additional points regarding the general theory of the absolute individual. The first concerns the resolution of the antithesis between rationalism and irrationalism. The rational does not possess an independent existence that allows it to oppose the irrational. Behind the rational, one will always uncover, as its root and determining principle, the non-rational. The soul then, that is, the imperative nature of certain laws of reason and of logic itself, let alone that autonomous ethics of the categorical imperative, is merely a manifestation of musan, which signifies being compelled, thus indicating a passivity and a dependence on an underlying force. Equally decadent and distant from the path of the absolute individual is the consideration of the irrational as an ungovernable reality, framed in terms of life, becoming, and similar notions. In this view, the self exhibits an exteriority to itself. Conversely, the integrated self recognizes the irrational as its own substance or potency, of which the rational is the expression. The more complete the potency, the more coherent its manifestations will be, possessing an absolute form, a law, a rationality across all levels. Thus, truth is also a reflection of potency. Paradoxically, I could assert, truth is a powerful error, error is a weak truth. From the perspective of the integrated self, something is not willed because it is recognized as right, rational, or true, rather, it appears right, rational, or true only because it is willed. Thus, that ACT of values was excluded. In recognizing this, I identified the soul distinction, on one side, being central to oneself, and on the objective level, the potency, on the other, not being central to oneself, which results in leaving the internal throne either empty or occupied by phantoms. The so-called voluntarism, which had previously been coherently asserted in philosophy solely on the theological plane with reference to a non-rationalistic conception of the divine, as articulated by Duns Scotus, God does not will something because it is good, rather, it is good because he wills it, was thus semantized and transferred to man. Here, as elsewhere, the potential for a catastrophic short circuit was evident for anyone who abruptly embraced such a perilous doctrine. The other point pertained to the realm of the extra-normal, as the path of the absolute individual was one that avoided the collapse of abstract idealism, the rhetoric and fiction of the universal subject were denounced, provided that possibilities opened up beyond the normal limits of human existence. Earlier, in essays, particularly in the chapter on the sovereign self, and subsequently in a section of Theoria, I addressed and re-evaluated the Kantian problem of a possible experience, or moglische Erfahrung, along with its transcendental presuppositions. Kant began with the assumption of a unique human experience, which could be framed within rational schemas that imparted a character of necessity and constancy, thereby enabling the possibility of synthetic a priori judgments, which he regarded as the cornerstone of all positive and universally valid scientific knowledge. To explain this, he traced the matter back to the categories and the transcendental function of the self, to which the very characteristics of necessity and incontrovertible determinacy, assumed in factual experience, were transferred. Indeed, the development of modern science had already undermined Kant's premise, the assumed constraints of necessity within nature had loosened. Bout-Roux, in a classic and pioneering essay, articulated the contingency of the laws of nature. Euclidean geometry itself had emerged as merely one among many possible geometries, and with the advent of subatomic physics, one had to grapple with indeterminism and the philosophical stance that emphasizes improbability or the unlikely nature of certain events or outcomes. Now, if one were to apply Kant's methodology in light of this altered premise, the result could only be a transcendental flexibilization, whereby the correlational counterpart would necessarily consist of a different, dynamic system of categories. Furthermore, the Kantian notion of possible experience represented the most banal and commonplace understanding, failing to consider the transcendental presuppositions or possibilities corresponding to equally real forms of experience, such as sleep, dreams, states of madness, and hypnosis, as well as all the extra-normal experiences that parapsychology and psychic research had recently substantiated. Lastly, it was essential to account for what could be gleaned from ethnology and the consistent testimonies of various traditions regarding a phenomenology of the extra-normal. The fact that all of this often exhibits a sporadic and exceptional character does not justify its exclusion from a possible experience. When considered in its entirety, this concept appeared markedly different from the one examined in the Critique of Pure Reason, which represents merely an arbitrarily absolutized portion of the former. I recalled, among other things, the depiction by D'Osti, the director of a parapsychology institute, of an individual who hypothetically possessed the combined possibilities of experience and the powers that had been positively verified in separate cases and under diverse circumstances. This notion was sufficient to open transcendental horizons and, in principle, to eliminate any limit that could effectively obstruct or refute the theory of the absolute individual. Naturally, a distinction and reservation were necessary regarding the entirety of the latent potentials derived from the concept of global to possible experience. A portion of these potentials was characterized not by freedom and a value, but rather by a spontaneity and passive activity. This was relevant not only to the transcendental correlatives of the contingent realm represented by the world of objects and physical experience, but also to many psychic phenomena that were overlooked, such as dreaming, in which one does not actively dream but is instead the dreamt or recorded solely by parapsychology. These phenomena often exhibit unintentional characteristics and are frequently associated with altered states of consciousness and trance. In this regard, I had already established the fundamental distinction that would guide my exploration in the domain I would subsequently pursue more decisively after my philosophical phase. There exists an extranormal regression, achieved through a transition into the subpersonal, the vital, or the unconscious, descending self-transcendence, and an extranormal positivity, genuinely supernormal, conditioned by an ascent beyond the ordinary human personality into a strengthening of all that constitutes clear consciousness, will, and inner freedom, ascending self-transcendence. Thus, after outlining the broader realm of possible experience, the realizational problem remained open, conditioned by the self and its vocation. In my philosophical works, the latter topics were addressed only tangentially, serving to reinforce the structure of the system of magical idealism. In Theoria, various other problems were explored, but it is unnecessary to delve into them here. Instead, I will briefly mention Phenomenologia, which was originally intended to constitute the second part of a single volume, with the first part being Theoria. Due to editorial constraints, however, it was published as a separate book in 1930 by Bocca. I employed the term phenomenology in its Hegelian sense, not in Husserl's. I was unfamiliar with Husserl at the time, and I am unsure whether he had even published his major works when I wrote the book in 1924. The phenomenology outlined here was a delineation of the epochs and categories that define the path of the absolute individual. This addressed a need connected to my further critique of absolute idealism. It was evident that, in the development of this philosophy, the idea, the act, or whatever else it had called its supreme principle, was only able to simultaneously encompass the totality of experience by becoming increasingly indeterminate, essentially reducing itself to the universal void or a priori of Gentiles' pure act or Weber's a knowledge, articulated in a weak and impoverished dialectic. In this guise, it appeared as a container that could hold anything or, to use Hegel's metaphor for Schelling's early philosophy of identity, like the night in which all cows are black, in which everything is simply thought or act. I have already spoken of the dreary impression left on me by the Italian neo-Hegelian epigones. Well, by boldly reaffirming the necessity of the doctrine of categories and, to some extent, the very philosophy of nature from the classical idealists, I instead sought to develop a system wherein the immanent principle would account for the essential components of our actual experience, as well as the notion of possible experience, in line with the previously discussed broader interpretation of that concept, articulated through a structured framework of distinct meanings and values. The realm of primordial spontaneity, the world of human personality and reflective thought, and the world beyond these, all of this was to be integrated and deduced within the process of the absolute individual, who seeks self-realization or manifestation. It is important to emphasize seeks, because, as noted, the opposite path, the path of the object, of samsara, the cycle of necessity and meaninglessness, was equally open to it, representing an identical possibility, and its choice remains free. The assumption was bold, and, as with similar constructions in classical idealism, my phenomenologia might be accused of a certain degree of arbitrariness. An objection in this regard could, however, raise concerns about a theory whose principle was absolute freedom, thus, in a certain sense, pure arbitrariness, a theory that proclaimed the primacy of will over truth. Essentially, it involved a personal effort to encompass, within a satisfying worldview, the entirety of the possible and the real. I was aware of the logical rigor required for the deductions and the structure of the dialectical argument. Amidst my challenging work, I found support for the aforementioned theory, as I noted how frequently an adequate mental effort was enough to furnish fundamental meanings with the rational foundation necessary for systematic unity. I can confidently say that I never allowed myself to be played by a thought, as occurs with those who believe in it without realizing the non-rational and existential foundation of the rational, those who, therefore, are thought more than they think. Simultaneously, in the introduction to the Phenomenologia, I addressed those who had followed my recent work, highlighting the congruence between various perspectives within the system and a non-philosophical traditional wisdom often conveyed through symbols and myths. Furthermore, I spoke of phenomenology because it was not merely a matter of determining simple logical forms, categories, or even transcendental conditions of experience, but essentially of experiences themselves. The distinctive character of my system, compared to other similar ones, lay in the broadening of horizons within the entirety of these experiences. Anything relating to what is merely and commonly human experience appeared only as a particular case. It is appropriate to quote a passage from the preface. We consider human condition in its totality as one of many possible conditions of individual existence, in no way privileged compared to others. Man neither begins nor ends with man, even though modern thinkers, aside from the chimera of faith and the constructs of the intellect, which remain part of what is merely human, have become incapable of knowing anything beyond that. We have restored to the human condition the sense of an episode, of a possibility, two significant epochs, which we term the era of spontaneity and the era of domination, serve as relevant frameworks for understanding and interpreting experiences and encompass various modes of existence that influence not only human experiences but also extend to broader aspects of existence. I further noted the idealist's view that, upon reaching philosophy, art, religion, or the ethics of the absolute state, the objective spirit, the process of spirit reaches its zenith and comes to a halt. I was particularly referring to Hegel and his epigones, reveals a limitation and a lack of metaphysical sense that is particularly distinctive in modern thought. Furthermore, that a modern world that does not represent a privileged condition, it is merely one appearance among many cultures. The very possibility of ending up in such astonishing, and dare I say, childish illusions paradoxically attests to the absolute freedom of spirit. From a deductive and constructive perspective, the framework of phenomenologia was as follows: the individual was posited as freedom and dominion. However, the self, in order to possess itself, must, in a preliminary ideal moment, simply be existing in immediate spontaneity, in the forms I termed passive activity. This brings about a series of determinations or positions bounded by the perfection of being. On one hand, the essential elements of sensory experience were defined. On the other hand, it became possible to refer, a posteriori, to what exists as the nocturnal remnants of primordial states of consciousness, evident in the mentality and experiences of so-called primitives, or in regressive forms that converge with them. Simple designations may convey little, especially given the specific meanings I assign to the various terms. Nonetheless, the era of spontaneity was articulated as follows. First section, quality, feeling, act, difference, causality, substantiality, otherness, including perception, affection, recognition, expression, and revelation. Second section, powers of existence, powers of organization, biologism, and the powers of the person. The concept of the person emerged at this juncture, at the conclusion of the first era, not in an ethical sense but rather as a mere human individuality, a boundary, so to speak, marking a point of crisis and transition from the naturalistic world. The force driving the transition from one form to another arises from the fact that the various aspects of being and the act of positing unfold spontaneously, influenced by a higher principle. Thus, the self transcends the limits of being, asserting itself in a non-being, which corresponds to being for itself. This manifests, through self-distinction, as the world of things or, more generally, as the non-self, what was previously united in a spontaneity, in perceiving, living, moving, etc. Consequently, a second era emerged, referred to as the era of reflection or genuine personality, characterized by self-consciousness and imagery. Existence grounded in reflective consciousness comes at the cost of self-alienation, leading one to live in a world of images and thoughts, framed by the duality of existence, subject opposed to object. The entirety of this second era corresponds to the activities through which the subject attempts to resolve the exteriorized world of being, now understood as that of the object, within the forms of reflective consciousness. In my framework, the first section encompasses finite experience, the active personality, self-preservation, cooperation, sexuality, and morality. The second section includes scientific, philosophical, and mystical consciousness, pure art, and finally, as a limit form that constitutes a new point of crisis and transition for the entire era, the individual. Just as the self-consciousness of the principle of the person affirmed itself by dissolving from being and opposing it, the principle of the individual, the first appearance of the absolute individual in its own form, entails a self. Distinction, opposing the entire realm of reflection and imagery, which is perceived as empty and unreal. This results in a return to being, now marked by genuine freedom and power, not pre-personal, but transpersonal. In the new era, the movement of reaffirming, uplifting, and transmuting is renewed. With the world of images and dual reflective consciousness swept away, like a now superfluous scaffolding, the individual re-establishes contact with the elemental world, which has descended into the deep strata of the spirit in order to transform it in the name of a value, in the specific sense previously mentioned, encompassing absolute meaning, autarky, freedom, and domination. Thus, the entirety of the third era aligns with the task of imagical idealism and embraces experiences that are, in a certain sense, transcendent. The content of a range of disciplines and experiences I gathered from the realms of asceticism and wisdom traditions, both initiatory and esoteric, was dialectically derived and deduced. The sections were as follows. First section, experience of fire, suffering and love, dynamic evocation, the world of the word, and the individuating individual. Second section, Lord of the Limit, Lord of the Vortex, an absolute individual. Toward the end of Phenomenologia, dramatization began to overshadow the philosophical and dialectical exposition. Through surreal imagery and a lyrical outpouring, I sought to convey the sensation of the pinnacle of all development, an absolute that also appeared as both the principle and the immutable, unnamed substrate of the entire phenomenology. In the conclusion, I aim to account for the ultimate apex of absolute freedom, considering a plurality of subjects, each with their differentiated experiences, their own paths, and their own movements. Indeed, while the various forms were speculatively presented according to the articulation and sequence I have briefly outlined, each was attributed only a formal character. This did not represent a continuous path of a more or less obligatory journey, rather, it illustrated a collection of possibilities, distinct, irreducible modes of experiencing the value and power of the absolute. Individual. In this sense, each category could encompass the whole, within each, the absolute. Individual was fully manifest as absolute freedom. I adequately clarified this specific concept in my presentation of the pinnacle of my theory. Even the slyest remnants of the concept of necessity were completely eliminated. In the preface to Theoria, I wrote, "Our claim may undoubtedly seem audacious. We assert that philosophy in general culminates in transcendental idealism, which inevitably leads to magical idealism. Beyond this, there is nothing more to be done in philosophy, unless philosophy is to admit that it cannot fulfill its intended purpose and is to exhaust itself in mere opinion, enslaved by the contingencies of the moment. If we are to consider any further development beyond magical idealism, it cannot fall within the realm of philosophy, rather, it must be entrusted to action. Our task has been to guide Western speculation toward this final step. We do not claim in any way that our work represents the very best that could be done. But that is important only to a degree. In what we have articulated across our three works, there is ample material for those who wish to understand. As for those who are unwilling to understand, even if we were to dedicate the considerable time we have left to perfecting, consolidating, and expanding the system, there are more meaningful pursuits to focus on instead, they would always find grounds for criticism and denial. What truly matters is that our demand is recognized, that there are individuals who grasp the meaning and necessity of this final step, and once understood, take action and move forward. With those who genuinely seek this, we will undoubtedly cross paths again. Just as I had concluded my brief artistic journey, I now brought my philosophical experience, in the strictest sense, to a close. Having set aside painting, abstract art, and the alchemy of the word, I definitively move beyond the realm of pure speculation. The impersonal task I had felt compelled to undertake in this field had been fulfilled. What impact did my doctrine of the absolute individual have at the time? It was minimal, as was to be expected for any thought that stray significantly from established paths. There were some mentions, particularly by non-specialist writers. I have a few of these references in front of me, kept only because they were included in an editorial notice from that period. Nicola Moscadelli, a poet I greatly admired, wrote, in Evola, "One encounters one of those figures who embody the essence of an era, types so distinctly shaped that few dare approach them, not because they feel too distant, but rather because they feel too close, and fear what this proximity entails." Psychologist Roberto Assagiolli remarked, "An original and daring work, deeply thought out, that cannot be ignored or easily dismantled. While it may unsettle those unaccustomed to this kind of spiritual nourishment, it opens a path for the willing toward the boldest and noblest adventure, the most perilous and captivating in which the human spirit can engage." Catholic writer F. Aquilanti noted, in Evola's system, "A brilliant, articulate, and lucid writer, the individual is a radiant reality. Everything has become action, power, dominion. The barriers fall. God is not in the infinite, rather, the infinite has been realized within us, and we are, in the darkness, the creators of God." Professor A. Belluigi observed, "In the gray landscape of pseudo-philosophy, J. Evola's thought emerges as bold, innovative, and rich with promise. He articulates demands keenly felt by all genuinely modern spirits, demonstrating his ability to navigate the heights and guide his companions along the way." Lastly, idealist L. Grassi commented, "In Evola's efforts and writings, there is an irresistible quality that attracts and binds us. The sharpness of his thought is remarkable, the eastern and magical apparatus of his doctrine formidable, and his style is as clear as a cutting sword, slicing through the dense underbrush of rhetoric. At that time, I received particular attention from educator Gino Ferretti and critic Adriano Tilga, who had developed his philosophical perspective through rigorous engagement with transcendental idealism and later shared my critique of the then-dominant Gentilianism. He included my writings in an anthology of Italian philosophers from the early post-war period. Later, Tilga lamented that I had lost myself when I left behind speculative forms to explore fields he could not follow due to his intellectualistic mindset. However, the mainstream press and official culture remained, and would remain, deaf to these ideas. What could I expect? In Italy, philosophy, aside from a few superficial essays published in the cultural sections of newspapers, was primarily a profession, specifically, the profession of university lecturers, complete with their factions and cliques. To attract attention, one had to fully immerse oneself in that environment, where written works primarily served as credentials for competitions and promotions, and thought was tailored to teaching. Yet, I was completely outside of all that. Moreover, could a theory of the absolute individual be conceived from a university chair? Or could I believe that, solely influenced by rigorous deductions, one or another of those petty bourgeois professionals of speculative thought would detach themselves from their familiar ideas and venture into unusual explorations? All the extra-philosophical references that my philosophical system was rich in served as a convenient pretext for ostracism. A system that even accorded a place to the world of initiation, magic, and other remnants of superstitious beliefs could easily be dismissed with a shrug. That I had framed all of this in terms of rigorous speculative thought was of little consequence. However, I misunderstood how my speculative efforts might be practically useful to others. My work was an introduction to a non-philosophical world, relevant only in the rare cases where ultimate philosophy had triggered a profound existential crisis. I also had to recognize, a realization that became clearer over time, that prior philosophical training, especially the habit of abstract discursive thought, was the least suitable foundation for resolving such crises in the positive way I proposed, through a transition to realizational disciplines. For those who had already crossed to the other side, this philosophical groundwork rooted in your modern thought was entirely superfluous. Consequently, I not only refrained from recommending but actively discouraged those who followed me in my subsequent activities from reading those three books of mine. In the domain where I operated, it was not about the demonstrating or the deducing, much less about the discussing. It was about recognizing or failing to recognize certain principles and truths based on a calling can. innate sensitivity, or an inner awakening. In any case, what I believed needed to be done was done. It so happened that many years later, 25 years later, I revisited those books of mine. Approaching them almost as if they were the works of a stranger, I believe I assessed them with a fair degree of objectivity and could not help but recognize in them a vigor of thought, thematic richness, and a boldness in confronting challenges with innovative, potentially transformative ideas, rarely found in the works of my contemporaries. Furthermore, I discerned in them clear anticipations of ideas that would later gain popularity, especially at the periphery of existentialism. The concept of the absolute individual unfolded as a form of positive existentialism, the existentialism of a man unbroken by his metaphysical situation, particularly in light of the intensified challenges faced in the contemporary era. Therefore, in the realm of secular culture, those works may not deserve to be entirely forgotten. In 1949, having some free time, I revised Teoria dell'Individuo Assoluto, correcting certain points and replacing some formulations with others that were more developed and mature. Since the first edition of the work had long been out of print and unavailable, a reprint of the new version, which has not occurred by the time I write these lines, could have value as a document and testimony. However, in practical terms, this value might only be recognized by a few, unless some figure from that culture, from which I have increasingly distanced myself, draws attention to the book.